Oh, right.
Hello
Go,
and
David.
welcome. Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Especially Interesting podcast from Orcademy. I'm your host, David Gray Hammond. I'm here with Tigger Pritchard, my other host, and we're here with Sally today. Sally, who are you and what are we talking about today?
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very, very excited. And so my name is Sally Nilsson, and I'm 56, and I'm here today to talk about my great-grandfather, Robert Hitchens, who was the final helmsman on the Titanic when it hit the iceberg.
Fascinating. Oh. Tigger and I have been really looking forward to this episode. And
oh no, when we first got the email, David was like, look at this, it's going to be great. And I got these emails and messages coming through. The excitement has been building up, which is absolutely superb. This is going to be lush. And now it's on to me as ever. So when did you first discover that you were awesomely autistic?
March 2021.
Wow. Late identification, I'm in a similar boat. Oh my God, that's not what I meant to say, but that kind of came out.
Oh, I love the puns, lots of puns.
No puns intended at all.
No, I love them, go for it.
As I was saying, I was like, don't say that, Tigger, be gone. But there you go, yeah, I'm in the same boat. The late identification is something I am obviously fascinated by, and traveling through myself on quite a fascinating journey. So we may dip into a bit of that, but it must be interesting because, I mean, one quick question I've got is you look back, don't you? You look back and then you look back with that kind of like set of glasses, if I may call it that. And I look back and I see so many points in my life where I go, ah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. And then it's that you know, infamous saying of it all makes sense. And it does now look back on decades. You and I are of a similar age. We don't look at it. And I look back at so many decades and I just go, yeah, no, that explains, and that explains everything. And it does.
And I'm not
I've
doing
got
a
the
plug.
Journey ahead.
This is not a plug, but it's just interesting because since March, I have rewritten my life story, but I am now rewriting my, I'm rewriting it. I'm doing my autobiography called The Alien Within. In fact, at the end of October, I have a whole week of solid writing. And I'm not talking about autism all the way through the book, but you will know the different spectrums and the different traits that I've got just by reading the life story. And it will include how I wrote The Man Who Sank Titanic. You know, you'll know about that. So I'm doing it again because it, you know, you get feelings of loss, you have a bit of grief, you get a bit of anger and a lot of identity stuff. But you know what, Tigger? Now I know who I am. And I feel so amazed by that because 80% of the neurotypical population probably don't really know who they are. And I feel whole. And it's just so incredible to feel everything, you know, I love it. So I love being autistic.
I've got to put my 10 pence in, as they say as well, for an analogy, but you're right. I'm beginning to feel more whole than I have in, you know, previous decades. And I have to say, David and other awesome human beings that I've met, my neurokin, have just become such a, even I'm not talking to you lot as you converse online sometimes, and I just keep checking the odd message because there's a lot going on. I feel in some ways like I belong like I've never belonged before. And that is just heaven. I wish I'd known decades before. Maybe I did.
But do
I
you?
But, you
do
know,
you,
it's
Digger,
a journey.
Because I don't know if I do. I was then and now I'm now.
I think and retrospectively, we can always think, can't we? You know, we can always look back, but you're right. One thing we have to deal with is where we are in the here and now and make a difference for that way on the timeline that we're stuck in, so to speak.
Yeah.
But thinking of timelines, we better get back to this because I'm eager. I am so eager to know more. So please tell us about your, why you're here. Tell us about your awesome story that you want to talk about.
Okay, so a brief sort of history of it. When I was 14, I was in a pub down in Southampton where I was born. I came up to Reigate in Surrey when I was 7 years old. And we used to travel down to Southampton. And one of the times that I traveled down there, we always used to go to the Sir John Barleycorn pub in Cadenham. And my granddad, Alf, he would be sat in the chair, smoking Woodbines with his yellow fingers and drinking his pale ale. And one time, when I was 14, just about to become a huge rebel, he sat me down and he said, "Do you know about your great-grandfather?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, he was at the wheel of the Titanic when it hit the iceberg. And later on, he shot someone and went to prison. And he wrote diaries in prison." And I went, "Oh, my God, that's incredible." And then I sort of felt that was really, really amazing. And then went back to being a teenager. And then I sort of thought about it as years went on. But in 2009, it was sort of building and building. And I was aware that the anniversary, the 100-year anniversary, was in 2012. And I was saying to my family and friends, nobody's written a book about Robert Hitchens. They always write a book about Molly Brown, the unsinkable Molly Brown, who was in the lifeboat with him. But and she's got musicals and books and all sorts of things like that, and theatre and everything. And Robert hasn't got anything. And he was vilified as a coward and a bully for his behaviour in the lifeboat for 100 years. So in 2009, with a couple of English O levels and, you know, auditory processing disorder when I was a kid, I thought to myself, well, I can tell a yarn. Somebody's got to do this. So I went to York University and did a 3-day writing course, a big conference, which was amazing. It was going to be a story for kids, but then it ended up being a biography. And so from 2010, for 6 months solid, I researched and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. But the thing I did, because I don't have any problem with authority, well, I do have problems with authority, but I don't have a problem with is talking to anybody. So I thought I need to get the experts on my side. And one of the biggest experts was this guy called David Lynch. And he was the historical advisor for Titanic, the movie. So I got in contact with him and I asked him to help me. And he helped me considerably. And all the authors of the main Titanic books, and there's 2,000 of them, but the top books, they all helped me considerably. And, oh, it's Don Lynch, beg your pardon, it's me, name blindness. Don Lynch, he wrote in my, you know, in the front page, you know, he congratulated me and he said, you know, I really hope that the book does well and everything else. And even with the theories I got in the book, to have that was amazing. So that was kind of it. So it's the story of him, my great grandfather, because he had a life before Titanic and a life afterwards. And the idea is to put the record straight, because I'm really to do with empathy and justice. You know, I'm not just saying that, it is the truth. I'm often helping the underdog, and I needed to change history. And I believe I did.
Absolutely fascinating.
Okay, so that's a amazing story of how you came to write this book. Would you be willing to tell us a bit more about your great-grandfather? And, you know, so you say he was the last helmsman at the wheel of Titanic when it hit the iceberg.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that? You know, does in his diaries, does he discuss it much?
It's quite funny with Robert Hitchens, because I wonder whether he was neurodivergent. I had his handwriting tested very forensically by quite a famous, can't remember how you say it, but handwriting expert in Sheen. And what came back from that, he was grandiose. He was a bit of a fantasist. He liked structure and routine. I don't know, he was so focused. I just wonder whether he was neurodivergent as well. But, I mean, the thing about Robert Hitchens, he had already had 12 years experience of sailing big ships, steamships, and also sailing ships and battleships. You know, he was taking troops over to India and up to St. Petersburg. He'd seen ice in the past. He was very, very experienced, and he was one of 6 quartermasters on the Titanic. So he knew what he was doing. I mean, I went on to Channel 4 News once with a lady called Sarah Louise Patton, and she'd gone on to Channel 4 News because she was the granddaughter of Charles Lightoller, the second officer. And she was on Channel 4 News to say that Robert Hitchens had turned the Titanic the wrong way and that's why it hit, which was absolute bullcocks. So I raced up there on the train to Channel 4 News and I sat down there and said my piece and I got her well and proper. But so anyway, he had loads and loads of experience. And, you know, he, on the night, he was in a tiny wheelhouse. I mean, it is really, really small. You know, I don't know if you can, well, obviously you can't see it, but my room is tiny. It's like 2.5 by 2.5 meters. And the wheelhouse is really, really small with blinds coming down. So he couldn't see anything. All he had was a board in front of him lit by a candle, which said the course and any tilt, how fast they were going, direction and all that sort of stuff. And so it was a very responsible job, but he was given orders and he always stuck to every single order, you know, and that's what he did. So that was his job really that night.
So you mentioned putting the record straight. So I know from what little research I've done there, and again, you've got the media representations come in and they change things and they have their kind of liberties as they always do with changing history or putting their slant in it, or depending what country's made the film and so on and so forth, in actually changing the historical narrative in so many different areas. But you mentioned about putting the record straight. What was that record that you were putting straight?
So for 100 years, Robert Hitchens was, as I say, he was vilified, but his reputation was absolutely shattered. Molly Brown, who was in the lifeboat with him, when they docked in New York, one of the first things she did was she got off the Carpathia, and after a day or two, she went to the New York Times. And she said that Robert Hitchens was shaking like an aspen and he was a coward and he was drinking all the whiskey and he was rude and swearing and he wouldn't go back for survivors and he was a bully and a coward and on and on. And so that stuck for 100 years that's what had happened. There was also something about Captain Smith and Lightoller. Apparently when the lifeboat was lowered into the water and Robert started rowing away from the boat, that there was a story that Captain Smith and Lightoller were telling him to come back. And that's just not true. That's not what happened. So I needed to put the record straight. If I had found out that Robert was a bully and a coward and that he'd drunk all the whiskey and he had been really, really awful, you know, I'm not saying he was an angel by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm sure he swore like a sailor because he was a sailor and he was from Cornwall. And, you know, he was a rough and ready guy, you know. But at the end of the day, I needed to say that he was just a man. He was just a quartermaster. He was following orders. He was told to row towards the ship that could be seen in the distance, drop off passengers and come back. He had 24 people in his lifeboat, mainly women, and they were screeching and shouting at him. And, you know, they were a mile away from Titanic. They were one of the first to leave. They were the third lifeboat to leave. They were a mile away from Titanic, you know. And as Titanic sank, there was no moon. They had no compass. It was pitch black. There was no way that he could go back to Titanic and pick up survivors. So they were screaming and shouting, and Molly Brown was getting up and trying to climb over the passengers and grab him. And they had a massive stand-up argument. So everyone believed Molly Brown to be the heroine of the piece for history, always, you know, musicals, theatre, books, everything. But I did so much research on Molly Brown, and I didn't find her that person. I found her quite a different type of person. And so I needed to put the record straight there. I needed justice for Robert. And also the other thing as well about changing history is that for 100 years, nobody knew what happened to him when he died in 1941. They knew that his ship, the English Trader, was moored out of Aberdeen waiting to go in. And he died of a heart attack there. And no one ever knew what happened to him. He disappeared. But 2 weeks before the anniversary, after so many telephone calls with libraries, morgues, hospitals, the council backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, I finally discovered that he was buried in Trinity Cemetery. So I flew up there and was met by a load of interviews, TV, radio, newspapers, everybody. And I made a homemade cross and took some flowers up because he shared his grave with two other seamen in a poor man's grave. And I was able to, I got rid of all the journalists and everyone and stood alone at the grave. And I just hoped that he was looking up at me and I was crying. And he believed that, you know, that hopefully he had a bit of a smile on his face and just sort of maybe was able to say, well done, Sally, thanks a lot.
Oh, I should think so. I mean, that sense of justice is something that I think is so important to so many of our New Yorkers, that sense of making sure the right story is told, to make sure that it, you know, that there are no falsities, that it is the truth, is something, you know, I feel very passionate about, that David does, and so many other individuals that I know as well. And it, and that drive to get that story right. And I mean, there was so much going on at the time, you know, it interesting to explore what, you know, the historical aspect of Molly Brown. Again, as you say, the papers have been looking for a story. The papers have been looking for something to get that front. And they do it today, don't they? They look for something to sell that front page, so to speak. Scandalous, sensational, boom, and off they go. And there are, I suspect, millions of individuals that have been caught that way because people just wanted to sensationalize something and to sell that story. But again, you know, from what little I'd read and from what you're telling me, also me so, you know, you're looking at a man that was trained, that was experienced, that followed orders. Do you know what I mean? And that doesn't, and that isn't the picture that various like media-based representations have shown and so on. You're showing a man that did it, possibly neurodivergent, to the letter of the law, do this, great, follows it. And again, you know, there were loads of people responsible for making sure that something didn't happen to Titanic on that night. And, you know, there's as I'm sure most people know, there's a long catalogue of things that could have happened, didn't happen, shouldn't have happened. And he's a very small part of that. But, you know, from what I read and from what you said, I see a man who was doing his job. Well, and there were other people around that had to do theirs.
Yeah, and that is absolutely it. And, you know, the facts are there. There are facts of that night without going into any theories, even though I have one of my own. But the fact was that Robert was on his own in the wheelhouse at 11:40. There was nobody else in the wheelhouse. It was him. You know, there were six other officers. Moody was off having a break. Boxall was off having a break. The captain had been at a lavish dinner made for him and he was in his cabin. Murdoch, I believe, was having a nap in the outer bridge. The two poor guys up in the crow's nest, Reginald Lee and Frederick Fleet, didn't have any binoculars. And that was terrible. It was very, very late on a Sunday night, a religious night. Everyone was in bed. There was a scratch crew. There was nobody out at all. They didn't have nearly enough crew around, bow lookouts and lookouts around the ship, knowing that they were heading directly for an ice field. And there were so many messages coming in. They were going at 22 and a half knots, which was too fast, knowing that they were going towards an ice field. Lightoller, he was in his cabin. You know, I mean, the thing is, you can read this in the absolutely fascinating US and British wreck inquiries. You can read it. The stories, how they changed and swapped around. It was a big whitewash. And in my opinion, yeah, I'm quite happy to say it was corporate manslaughter.
I think I did delve into it because I'm one of those individuals that went and saw the Titanic and then went research. And then went, oh, yeah, usual Hollywood film, an awful lot's been changed, yeah? And I remember at the time the situation with, anybody, they did, in those days, there wasn't any, you know, sonar or ping or anything like that to see what was going on. It had to be people with binoculars. And they didn't have any, did they? Somebody had gone off with a key or something, wasn't it, if memory serves?
Yeah, that's right.
So the binoculars were there, locked in a cupboard, and nobody had access to it.
Yeah, but there were five or six pairs of binoculars down in the outer bridge. Nobody thought to say, "Here, Fred, we're heading for an ice field. I have some of these, love." And the thing is that I know because every time I came across something that could be argued about, I went off on a massive research thing. So the thing about the binoculars was that I know that the guys in the crow's nest, they will always be looking with their naked eye first. And then if they see something, they lift the binoculars. But this was not a small iceberg. And they had been ringing the bell at least twice and ringing the wheelhouse before they hit the iceberg. So they'd already seen ice before Titanic hit. And all of this was covered up. All of this was covered up.
I know. I think they were late. They were speeding. I know the bit about the lifeboats. They were supposed to be, I don't know, 70 or something. I can't remember. And they ended up being like, I don't know, 30 or something, because it looked more aesthetically pleasing. All this I've read over the years, yeah? And you can see an absolute catalogue of errors. And I think, well, as nobody gets me for suing me, but I think, you know, the corporate manslaughter, there's an absolute backlog of things that were changed just in the design of the ship when she went out, and the speed and the binoculars and the ignoring warnings and so on, that just makes it, yeah, like so many, you know, things that have happened regrettably that could have been avoided. But your passion, your drive to get his story out there, any obstacles out of interest? Any people that horrendously disagreed with you? Or was it the fact that you uncovered this information, you were able to say, look, this is what I found, this is documentation?
It was quite funny, actually, because the emotion of writing it, when I wrote some of the stuff about Robert that was just so tragic. But there was one particular area, and I had spoken to the experts about it, and I was warned not to do it just because it didn't follow form. But I'm not a conformist. I do not conform. I go my, you know, this is what I was finding, and I decided to do it. So William Murdoch, who was the first officer, I believe that he had, after the Wideners had done this lavish lunch for Captain Smith, I believe that the officers were in some cabins further down the ship having a drink, and William Murdoch was in the outer, on the outer bridge, and he had the heaters on, and it was quiet, and there was no crew around, it was late, and I believe he fell asleep. And so the guys in the crow's nest were ringing the bell and ringing the phone and all this kind of stuff. And that can't be more controversial than you can believe. So I was having imaginings that the Clan Murdoch were going to be coming down on the train, you know, waving pitchforks with their kilts flying. And I did get really hammered by a guy who runs a website about William Murdoch. But the thing is, I'm not scared. I was bullied terribly at school. I don't take it anymore. So I stood my ground 100%, and it's in the book, and it stays in the book. This is what I believe. And it's for the reader to make their mind up.
Yeah, yeah.
And quite frankly, you know, people are reading the book, and it's a possibility because people are human. That's the thing. People make Definitely. Human errors. And that is...
I remember reading somewhere about their lavish lunches. And their lavish lunches, especially the ones at the weekends, were like almost like all-day events with, you know, not four, five or six courses. I think they had lots of courses. And you could imagine, you know, you're there for, I think it was supposed to be 6 hours worth of sitting down with the captain and eating and all this stuff. After that, you're like, you know, I'm like, you know, after a three course meal, I'll go and sit down, relax and nod off for a bit. And you know, and the lavishness, the lavishness of the first class was absolutely incredible. The alcohol, the drinks, the courses they went through. Yeah, no, I can imagine anybody would. Just,
you know, the rules, the absolute rules are nobody is allowed to touch alcohol. And Captain Smith, I believe he didn't touch any alcohol. He had a couple of Cuban cigars. But just because the rules are there, it doesn't mean to say that you don't break them.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, you can certainly see that. And another thing before David must have asked a question I was thinking of as well, was that he was a Cornishman. Because New Lynn, to me, is kind of down there. Right.
So I
know that because I'm based in Bodmin at the moment. So I'm based in Cornwall. So I know New Lynn, the fishing village beautiful place, absolutely beautiful.
And Mausel, it's absolutely gorgeous.
Oh, God, yeah. But, you know, what a harsh job to have in those days, you know, to fish with the kind of storms we have around this kind of coastline, et cetera, and so on. But no, he was I am a Cornishman, I am a Celt. So he's a fellow Celt, I'll say, yeah. But that he was actually, you know, born just down the road from me is kind of like something I didn't know. And found that out in my bits of research. That was absolutely fascinating as well. David, old chap, what thoughts are going through your awesome brain?
Well, obviously, we've alluded to the elephant in the room, which is the fact that there was a very well-known film made about the Titanic. Personally, even because I was relatively young when that film came out, you don't have to look at me like that.
You have to do this age thing to me every time. I know. I cannot remember how old I was when I watched it.
But even then, I remember thinking that this film is so over-dramatized that I don't feel like I'm seeing the reality of what actually happened. You know, I'm not sure this is the exact thing I want to say, but the best way I can describe it is I felt like I didn't really see the humanity of the people who were on that ship. You know, it was very obvious to me that they wanted to portray certain people as heroes and certain people as villains, rather than what we've discussed about so far, which is the reality that everyone on that ship, you know, had a responsibility, or at least everyone, you know, running that ship had a responsibility to an extent for the goings on, and they were humans and humans make errors. And Sally, I was just wondering, in particular, was there anything about the film that you felt they got wildly inaccurate? Is there anything here you'd like to set the record straight on?
Well, I mean, there's two things, two or three things. You know, I don't mind the film. It's okay. It's what it is, really. I think A Night to Remember is a preferable film, if I'm honest. Although they had Charles Lightoller as such a hero, and I don't think he was a hero particularly. But just a couple of the things. They did quite a good job of the collision scene, but this was their story of it. But it was also Robert Hitchens' story of it. So actually, between Charles Lightoller and Robert Hitchens, who stood up at the US inquiry and the British Wreck inquiry, it was their witness statements. So between them, they were asked hundreds of questions. And it's that story is what you see on Titanic the movie. And actually, they did quite a good job of that. But what they didn't do, apart from the fact that it's all rubbish, because if you'd been a real fly on the wall in the wheelhouse, they were coming up with what they were going to say and putting their story, because that's the whitewash of it. But one thing that was quite funny in Lifeboat 6, which is Robert Hitchens' lifeboat, on the movie they had Robert as this tall, skinny Cockney guy who said to Molly Brown, "If you don't shut that hole in your face, there'll be one less in this lifeboat." Now, Robert Hitchens was 5'6", stocky, steely blue eyes with a very, very strong Cornish accent. And so he didn't say those words. Those words were said, but they were said by the guy who was commandeering Lifeboat 8.
It's whenever I see, I mean, I am a geek. So even when I watch The Imitation Game and I've got books on that awesome gentleman and so on, you just sit there and I love the dramatic side of it. I always keep telling my brain, this is a fictional representation. This is a fictional interpretation. And yeah, I remember what was the one I hated most of all, I think. It was that American film about them finding the Enigma machine in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean or something. And was it U-Boat 51 or something it was called? And people believed that was real history. That's the power of the media, which is really annoying. And I can understand then your drive to, no, this is false, this isn't true, and I've got to get the record straight. Because that's something I very often, you know, it's like new info dump. If we're watching a film, I say, well, actually, the computer wasn't that size, and actually that didn't happen, and actually it didn't hit me the phone, and I'll go on when I know the story behind, because I just can't stand. But I suppose if I do love the media, as many of us do, and I think, you know, sometimes you have to just, you know, I often say to people, that was a fictional representation of an actual event. because they always change things.
Doing the research though, I was coming at it by a multi-pronged attack, finding different ways, so many different creative ways to find research. And one of the parts of Robert's history, which is an incredible part, was he was on a cargo ship during the Battle of the Atlantic. And I didn't know anything. I'm 56, but when I was at school, we never covered the Battle of the Atlantic. It was always Auschwitz in World War II. And the Battle of the Atlantic was so incredible about getting goods home. And the way I learned about it, one of the main ways I learned about it, was through the film Cruel Sea. And that film was absolutely spot on, and it was incredible. And when I watched that film and the footage, because they had a lot of real footage there, I saw, I know my arms are going hairy just thinking about it, I saw Robert Hitchens on his on the English Trader bringing grain, taking coal to Africa and bringing grain back from Buenos Aires. You know, so some films, when they get it right, are absolutely amazing. They really are. But what is sad is that many of us poor souls are having to watch things believing it to be true when it isn't. You know, with Titanic the movie, so many people think that Rose and Jack are real. I mean, for goodness sake.
I know. And It does, with that passion and that drive to, oh my God, I want historical reality to be there. Whenever they redo something, I always kind of like semi, you know, groan in anticipatory kind of fear and disgust almost as what they're going to do to history this time. And what I do find really sad is that you have a large younger population that takes what they see on screen as reality.
Yeah.
And that's what worries me, is because Turin, you know, Titanic, other stories, you know, finding the enigma in the ocean, all that, they go, that's what happened, isn't it? And you think, no, it's not. And it's that almost, what I do worry about sometimes is that so many individuals get their education from that celluloid, if I can call it that, experience, whichever format they watch it on. And then they take that to be historical evidence. And that is something which I wish didn't happen, could be changed. But we've got an absolutely amazing, fascinating Cornish individual here, which is superb. And again, from what I've read, and I'm just looking at some stuff here, is the fact that he had life before. He's famous for the Titanic period, but he was an experienced, trained seaman. And then, as I say, after the Titanic, he went on to, you know, take part in wars and so forth before he sadly died. So what did he do after this had all, you know, the tonight bit of car, he had to get on with his life, he had to earn a living.
So very, very interesting. The only one of the officers, Harold Lowe, he went back to Wales. He was seen as a hero, even though he waited until most people had died before he went back and picked up a couple of survivors. But when they came back to England and both the inquiries were over, the officers kept their jobs or, you know, had similar jobs. Robert Hitchens ended up in South Africa.
Wow.
So, you know, that begs the question, why did he end up in South Africa when he had two daughters and his wife had just given birth? His wife, Florence, had given birth to my grandmother, at 6 months after Titanic sunk. And he was in South Africa. He didn't want to go to South Africa. He was sent to South Africa to get him away because he was a bit of a loose cannon and he was an embarrassment and they couldn't, you know, the White Star Line couldn't keep him in England. So he went to South Africa. He wasn't sailing boats, a couple of small ships apparently, but he did have time to come back. He did come back a couple of times because there were two more children. So he did come back to see Florence. But in August of 1914, Robert came back to Portsmouth and he was barracked on the HMS Victory. He was actually barracked on that ship, ready to mobilise for World War I. But he started having really bad symptoms. His back went like rock. He had terrible nightmares. He was shaking, couldn't eat. He was in a hell of a state. And the doctor said that he had neurasthenia, which would be similar to PTSD. And he was invalided out at that point. And I didn't know this by the time the book was published, but I found out afterwards that months later, when he'd been to a sanatorium and recovered, he did go to France, and he was in an artillery unit. So he did, and he got his British World War One cross. In fact, he got two medals. So, you know, he we know that he gave good service. He did what he was supposed to do. He'd gone through a really, really difficult time, but he'd had enough of the sea. After he came back from South Africa and come out of the war, he didn't want to sail the big ships. So him and his family, there were now five children, moved back to Torquay, where he'd come, where he'd got married to Florence. He originally came from New Lynn in Cornwall. And but he looked very dapper and well-to-do. And somehow they had money. They had enough money for Florence to buy or set up a B&B with her sister. And Robert had enough money, also getting a loan from a horrible loan shark, to get a paddle steamer called the Queen Mary. So he was, and then unfortunately the depression of the 30s came up, and the horrible guy, a guy called Harry Henley, wanted his money back and was threatening the family, and everything was getting so awful. Robert started drinking, his mental health started really declining. Florence went back to Southampton with the children, and Robert, he started going around the country trying to find work, and he'd fill in little notes to sell, excuse me, which I've seen come up in auction. I've got one photocopied somewhere.
Wow.
Saying, you know, helmsman of the Titanic with a loss of 1,500 souls and all this sort of thing. And so anyway, one of the things that he bought with the money that he got from these was a small silver gun. And he wanted the gun because he blamed everything that had happened on this bully, this Harry Henley guy, who had taken, who, you know, was bullying the family and threatening him. So he came back to Torquay, found the guy, was very drunk on whiskey, and he shot him. And he shot him, and it hit him on the, it glanced off the side of his head. Robert was arrested, and 2 weeks later came up in front of the judge. But the judge knew that he'd been in the war, and he had his war medals, and that he was very, very down because of his experience on Titanic. So rather than getting the hangman's noose, he was sent to Parkhurst for 5 years hard labour. And then he came out in 1937 and had 3 years with his wife before, sadly, she got a brain tumour. And he didn't want to stay in Southampton anymore. So This is when he went up to Liverpool and got on the English Trader, taking coal over to South Africa, to Africa, and bringing grain back from Buenos Aires. I mean, it's all this is full of much more detail that I'm telling you now. And this is what he did. So, you know, and actually when he was on the English Trader, he was third officer. So that was quite an amazing thing for him to have been able to be third mate, because that would have been a promotion from quartermaster. And he said on the English Trader, he was very depressed and very ill, and he just wanted to be with Florence. He was so depressed. And of course, me being sentimental and the suffering, you know, I suffered with Robert suffering, like I can't tell you. I really took all of his suffering into my body and my mind. And so I say at the end, you know, he died of a broken heart. You know, why not? You know, it's quite a nice way to end.
I'm old romantic as well, and I can certainly go with that. And I think that, I mean, his journey is harsh, fascinating, beautiful, hard fought, and full of the kind of trauma. And you know, and the you know, we'll get stressed by there not being enough eggs in the supermarket or something. Do you know what I mean? And you look at what our, you know, generations, pre generations had to go through, like, you know, my grandparents, your family, and you just think, wow, you know, you just think it's incredible. His life story is absolutely incredible, and it's really awesome that with your focus and your passion and your drive for justice, that you decide to go, no, sorry, I'm going to research the truth, find out what the truth is, and then get it out there for all to see. And I think that's just, it's just absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. We will make sure in the links to this podcast, everybody, the your media details are there, where to get the books, so on and so forth. It's just absolutely brilliant. It's bringing history to life, isn't it? It's where you do see so many media representations. I told you I hate them already. I love them, but I kind of hate the fact they're not factual. But it's where you realise you can almost smell the truth of the situation, yeah, which you don't get on the screen. And it's fantastic.
But I love, one of the things I love the most is, you know, I wrote the book and I thought, well, you know, I can't leave it at the book. I've got to keep telling his story. And so since 2012, I've done so many public speaking opportunities, you know, schools, history clubs, the Women's Institute, ProBus, you know, the men's business groups. And I love getting up and talking for an hour. And each group I talk to, I can change it. I will adapt the talk to who I'm talking to. So if I'm talking to five-year-olds, it's all exciting and everything else. And if I'm talking to teenagers, it's gory. If I'm talking to women, it goes the love side. And if I'm talking to men, it's all the black gang and the technical side of it. And I love doing that. So my next thing is I'm on the... I'm on speakers, you know, the speakers thing, and I'm waiting to start hopefully doing after dinner speaking, because you can really make it very entertaining depending on who audience is. And it's timeless. The thing is,
Want this, don't they? People want this because it is reality. It's not the Hollywood glazed interpretation. Absolutely it is not. Real life from, a lineage relative, and it is true and it's gorgeous. So, thank you so much for this. All the details have been the podcast details.
Thank you, and
I think young David.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, I was always aware of just how many souls were lost on Titanic, but you've really brought to life one of the souls that went on after Titanic, and I truly think you are setting the record straight, and that is a beautiful thing to do, and it is such a fundamentally autistic thing to do as well, to have that drive for justice and set the record straight. And yeah, we will, like we said, we'll make sure there's links to your book and anything else you want links to, you know, in the description of this podcast. But we always finish with the same question. We already gave you a heads up on what it's going to be, so you know what's coming. Sally, what is your favorite stim?
Thank you very, very much, Tigger and David, for inviting me on the podcast. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and it's so lovely to meet you both. You do such a great job. I love Orcademy. It's just amazing.
Thank you.
I'm putting it off. I don't care, because now I'm autistic, ADHD, and whatever else is in my bucket of spectrums and traits. I love talking about stims. They fascinate me. So in all my honesty, I suck my thumb.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nothing.
And I love it.
Isn't it lovely to be proud of your stim? I mean, there's so many things happening in schools, education. Be careful, we haven't got hours to go on, because we could, about where it's like we are being denied yet another aspect of our identity. And I have now started taking this out with me. Because I'm
can't see that very well. What is it?
Yeah, it blurred it out.
Sorry, it's one of mine.
Oh, yeah, I have silly putty. Pink silly putty. Yeah. I love
and
it.
I just think, and forgive my French here, it's like, sod you, this is my stim, and I'm going to go out with it. And I've now started doing the finger thing in public. So I was in Iceland, and there are other shops I go to as well. It just happened to be that one I was in. And I was listening to music, and I was conducting it. And somebody just walked by and just looked at me, and I thought, and?
So for anyone...
Teach the world stim in perfect harmony.
I know.
So for anyone listening, what Tigger just held up was a large cube of blue tack, and that's what he takes everywhere with him, and it's excellent. I know I need things to stim with all the time. I'm constantly carrying various things in my pockets and bag, so yeah, that's. Sally, thank you so much. It has been really such a fantastic podcast episode. I can't wait to share it with people. I cannot wait to share it with people. And on that note, that brings us to the end of this podcast. This has been the Especially Interesting Podcast from All Academy. We have been your hosts, David Graham and Tigger Pritchard. We've been here today with Sally Nilsson. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will see you all at the next episode. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Stay safe, everybody. Bye.
Bye.